1 Corinthians 5, 3 through 5, that's where we want to start. You may remember from 1 Corinthians 5, verses 1 and 2, we sort of have the stage set. Paul is talking to the Corinthians. From all we can tell, there is a man, a Christian, who is living with his father's wife. That would be his stepmom. Based on the information that we have, and there's not a lot, it seems like the stepmom is not a Christian. So this member of the church has gotten hooked up with her. We talked about the fact that the present tense is used, so this is an ongoing thing. Bad enough would be one time, but this is something that is habitual, and it does seem like the husband of the stepmom is still alive. So as you start piecing these details together, this is about as bad, this is about as awful as it can be. But the Corinthians took it one step further. Were they ashamed of it, or were they proud of it? They were proud. It was like, well, look how tolerant we are. We think that this is okay, this is a good thing, and maybe even some of the teachers that we have support this kind of thing. Then we get down to verse 3. We started that last time. Let's read it, and we'll just kind of pick up about where we left off. He says, "For I truly, being absent in body, but present in spirit, have already, as though I were present, judged him that hath so wrought this thing," that is, the man who is living in sexual immorality, "in the name of our Lord Jesus, when ye are gathered together, and my spirit with the power of our Lord Jesus, to deliver such a one unto Satan for the destruction of the flesh, that the spirit may be saved in the day of the Lord Jesus." You find Paul at different times in his life, he goes and appeals to authority. We do the same thing today, do we not? What are there times where we appeal to authority?
Laws are broken.
Okay, I'm thinking specific instances though, specific examples of where we appeal to authority. To make a point. When, where, how is that done?
When our rights have been violated.
All right, sure. Someone would say, for example, you know, First Amendment. We've got a First Amendment to speak. Or we've got their freedom to assemble. So if somebody comes along and says, get lost, hey, we're in a public place, we're in a public street, our country allows me to do this. Somebody says, well, you have to, you know, take your sign and go somewhere else. No, we're in an area which allows us to protest. You might not like the message. So that would be one good illustration. What else? Where do we try to pull from as far as authority? What kind of situations, circumstances?
What about children denied to go to public school?
Okay, help me develop that. We would say, for example, if the state want, are you thinking maybe along the lines of homeschooling, where the state would say, we want your kids in school, and we would say, we appeal to the law which says that we can homeschool, maybe something along those lines?
Well, that or maybe some schools aren't set up to accommodate disabled children. Maybe they don't have ramps or elevators.
Okay. Yeah, we would appeal to law, and we would do that. If we take that illustration, then someone says, look, we have some rules for people who are handicapped. We have some rules for people who are disabled. You violated the laws. I remember, several in here will remember Lou Weaver. I don't know if you remember this story or not, but there is, at least there used to be, a sign over in Mishawaka, South Bend, in the post office. Anybody ever remember her telling that story? Okay, Lou had some issue, and she had some health issues, so she actually pressed that and won. I don't know that she actually took him to court, but whatever law was invoked, she appealed to, I'm going to say the American Disabilities Act. It may not have been that, but that would have been in the general category, and they actually had to post a sign which said, we do not discriminate against disabled people. So if you start doing things which discriminate against handicap, or you don't recognize, you know, for example, you say, well, we're not going to put up a ramp here. You know, we've got 500 people and you're the only one that needs it. You're probably in hot water. So when authority, true authority, is appealed to, that gets attention, at least it should. And that's what Paul is doing here. He says, when ye come together, when you gather together, when would they be doing that? All right, we're thinking about an assembly. More than likely, he's talking about a Sunday assembly. But he says, when this happens, then I'm telling you, in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, by the power, with the power of our Lord Jesus Christ, everything is coming together to deal with this situation. When we think about withdrawing fellowship, we've already talked about this to some degree, so I'm not going to go back and say a lot about it. But if you're going to do something that is this serious, for example, we've done some things over here over the years. We're trying to work out some singing bugs at one time. We've had a couple campaigns. If you're going to do something major like that, what percentage of the congregation do you want present? Yeah, ideally 100%. Now, sickness and work and, you know, there are different things. People may be out of town on vacation, those kinds of things. But you really want 100% participation. The world recognizes that, too. Several of us, as far as secular employment, we've been in a position where they're coming around for UNICEF or they're coming around for some of the drive. They're looking for money for this benevolent work, that benevolent work. And you sometimes see the little thermometer there on the wall. What's at the top of the thermometer?
100%.
So what are they striving for?
Everybody.
They want everybody in that organization to donate. What happens if they only get 10% of the people pitching in some cash?
They're not going to hit their goal.
All right, well, they're not going to hit their goal, and they're probably not going to be very happy. You have to have everybody on board, or almost everybody on board. And congregationally, that's also true oftentimes. So this is what Paul is trying to get done at Corinth. Now, he wants to, as you look at 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 5, this is really where we start as far as new material. He says, you take this guy, this Christian, who is involved with this fornication, and we want to deliver him, kind of like UPS or FedEx. Where are we going to put him? We're going to deliver him to
Satan.
We're going to deliver him to the devil. We're going to deliver him to Satan. Now, if you have some commentators or you maybe do a little thinking about that, check the internet, you can find that there are a lot of different ideas about that. There are some, for example, who think that Satan was allowed to somehow personally punish this guy. And that certainly is an illustration. I don't know that that, though, is the best illustration. Thinking through that in kind of a general way, if this guy is doing what Paul has said, he's doing the kinds of things. I mean, he is so far off the map that would he be regarded as a faithful Christian? I mean, he's already outside. Basically, he's put him outside. He's put himself outside the grace of God. So if you deliver him to Satan, and Satan starts to pound on him in a while. I mean, the devil begins to punish him. What might that guy do? Well, yeah, I mean, you would think, right? I mean, if he's enjoying himself and the devil goes after him in that kind of way, he'd be thinking, well, you know, there's safety and there's refuge in God, so let's just go back there. And would that help or would that hurt the devil if he goes back to God?
Hurt the devil.
All right, that hurts the devil. So that, to me, doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, if the rat is eating the cheese, what do you do?
Give him more cheese
so you don't give him more.
Well, I'm thinking if you want to poison him. You keep him. I should have added that little detail. Sorry about that. I still don't claim to be 100%. So, all right. You want to keep him there, right? And that's the devil. You know, if you got him, then you don't cut off the cheese, do you? You know, you keep giving him the good stuff, you know. You enjoy this, so we've got some more stuff that you can enjoy. I mean, let's make it a real smorgasbord. So there is some thinking, but again, it's just really, really hard for me to believe that. Then you also have this little point. 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 7 and 8. Paul addresses this point again. Now, that's a different letter. And there's some time between letter number 1 that we're talking about here and letter number 2. If then this idea of delivering this fellow to Satan meant that the devil was going to beat him up, and maybe even some would say go so far as kill him, then how successful was the devil when you get over 2 Corinthians chapter 2? Not very. So, however you explain this, and I do think we've got a reasonable way to explain it, I do not think that both of those are correct. When we look at the devil, the Bible teaches, and you can see this in a lot of different places, John chapter 12 and verse 31, Jesus talked about the devil being the one who is in control of the world. Also, some other passages as well. Don't want to give you that one right now, otherwise that'll really clue you in. But when you think about the devil and his relationship to the world, what is it? Satan's relationship to the world. What position does he have?
Very active.
Well, doesn't the Bible say, 2 Corinthians 4:4, that Satan is the God, Satan is the ruler of the world? It does. That's what we read about as far as when it comes to Satan. So if you're going to turn this one over to Satan, and Satan is the one who rules the world, I don't think it's much of a stretch to say that what's he saying? This fella, not literally over to the devil, but what's he saying? You're turning him where? He used to be where spiritually? In Christ, and what was his relationship to the church? Saved or lost?
Lost.
I believe it was saved.
He was saved. He was a Lamb of God. He was a child of God. But if you turn him over to Satan, he's lost. And where are you putting him? You're saying he's no longer in the church. I mean, he still might try to attend, but he's no longer in the church as far as fellowship with God. Where is he? He's over there with the devil and with the devil's realm, which is the lost, the world, the unsaved. I think that's simply another way of saying that we are talking about disfellowship. Now, somebody says, now, wait a minute. I had a thought. Let's go back to Acts chapter 5. We've got some information about Ananias and Sapphira in Acts chapter 5, verses 1 through 11. And that is true. There are some people who would say that Ananias and Sapphira were killed by the devil. If you heard someone say that, what might you be thinking or saying? Do you believe that? Ananias and Sapphira, killed by the devil or no? All right, I've got at least one taker for a no. Anybody want to be a yes? Well, that makes it easy. Why would we say no? They were not killed by the devil. I mean, the Bible, let's preface that with another question. Does the Bible specifically tell us who killed them, God or the devil? It does not. You can't find anybody behind that. But thinking through that, just like what we're doing here in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, would it have made sense for the devil to have wanted him dead? No. I mean, the longer they live, the better it is, right? For him? I mean, he's already got a road in with a husband. He's got a road in with a wife. And, you know, you let that kind of thing go. And what's that going to say about the early church? You can live in what kind of way? And, hey, God's good with you. He's not going to do anything. Any way you want. He doesn't care. He's not going to do anything. The idea that Christ is the head of the body and he cares as far as the shenanigans that people pull? No, no. So, logically, I think we have to say that the way that they died, the timing of the death, there was supernatural activity there, and that, in my mind, points virtually exclusively to God. So trying to run over there and say, aha, we've got the devil killing people in Acts chapter 5, and when this guy gets delivered to Satan, Paul's talking about the same kind of thing here. It's kind of apples and oranges. It's not an exact comparison, but it's also true that the devil, I believe, was not involved in Acts chapter 5, but here he is involved, at least to the extent that he is the one who is in control of the world. Anything that you want to add or ask before we talk about the destruction? Betty? Yeah, that is true. You know, sometimes
I'm not saying that he was, but I mean, I can see where some people might.
Yeah, it's almost like the gambler.
Yeah.
You go down and you go to the casino and you put in some money in the slot machine and you win $5. Can you walk away?
Most people can.
Well, no, you only gamble a corner. You got $5. Can you walk away?
Potentially,
you can. But you're right, most people won't do that. They're thinking, I only invested a quarter, I did have to invest something, for 25 cents, I got $5. And that's good, I've gained a lot compared to the quarter. But
if I use five, maybe I get 100.
Exactly right. And I think the devil has to think in that way. I've got two, we don't know how large your congregation was at Corinth, but if you've got two, or in this case one for sure, how many more can I grab? So sometimes it's just worth pushing the envelope to see. So you're exactly right. But looking at least from what we can discern about the devil, he does seem to be soul greedy, so to speak. And if I've got him, chances are I can keep him. So let's see if we can get some more. That's him, and then Gary, and then maybe somebody else.
Concerning Ananias and Sapphira, the devil did kill them spiritually.
Yes. Yeah, and that is true. That's what he's after. You still may have a long life and maybe even in some respects a productive life, but that is the end goal. And if he can get your eternal spirit and then along the way give you some grief, end your life prematurely, fill it with all kinds of sorrow and awful things, you know, that's just kind of the icing on the cake. But
well, he tried that with Job.
Yes.
But it didn't work.
Yes. Yeah. And he's still up to those same old tricks. Gary?
If someone were to go down the road that Betty was talking about, you could also say that the devil wouldn't be the one that killed him because there could be people that would think that God did it and that God is active because of the timing. So God, the devil's not going to waste an opportunity to give God credit like that.
Yes. Yeah. He's very shrewd in that way. I mean, he's sort of a master planner, so to speak. I mean, not master compared to God, but at least as we understand planning and as we think about strategy, those kinds of things, if we were to sit across from him as far as board game with strategy, I'm not sure we'd ever pull one out as far as a win. Tim, back to you.
He's nowhere close to approaching God, but he's a whole lot shrewder than we are.
Yeah. And, you know, we talk about playing for keeps sometimes. Somebody will sit down with a person to play a game. I'm playing for keeps. And maybe they really want to win and they play very, very hard. But the devil takes that to the nth degree. And whatever he has to do, I mean, he will. That's just his nature. Is that it? Betty?
The story about Ananias and Sapphira, you know, Peter asked them, why did they test the Spirit of the Lord?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that kind of leads you to believe that it is Christ that...
Yeah.
And that would, and it's, like you said, if he let that go, basically, it's like, well, they got away with it, why can't I?
Let's see if we can go back and pick up one more point from there based on what you said. Verse 11, and great fear came upon the whole church and upon all that heard these things. You don't have a specific object for the fear there, but who does it sound like the people feared? Were they in fear of the devil or were they in fear of God?
In fear of God.
All right, I think that's kind of implied, strongly implied. And why would they be in fear of God?
Well, because Peter had asked them, why did they test the Spirit of the Lord?
Yeah. It was God.
Yeah.
You know, if it had been the devil, then fear him because he's the one that did.
But I was kind of playing the devil's advocate.
Sure,
that.
Yeah.
That's where people yeah. can come up with the fact that it was the devil.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. You're right.
So, yeah.
That it? Okay. Let's go back to the word destruction. That's in verse 5. You find it also in the Thessalonian letters, 1 Thessalonians 5, 3, 2 Thessalonians chapter 1 and verse 9, and then you also find it in 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 9. There is a good cross-reference here, I think, and that is in 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 20, Paul said that Christians were delivered to Satan so that they could be taught not to do what?
Sin.
Well, you're close. Taught not to blaspheme. Remember that verse? Taught to not blaspheme. There again, I think you see the idea of we're going to deliver them to the world. We're going to put them outside the church. They're going to be disconnected from us. And they will hopefully realize just how awful they acted. All right, you also have a couple of other passages here that could be used. Romans 6 and verse 23, the Bible says, sin pays a wage. And that's what you find here with this fellow. Sin was going to pay a wage, and he was going to be cast out. In our area, we've talked about this a few times over the years. The Amish have been sometimes highlighted negatively for the practice of shunning people. We would probably use the word disfellowship, but that is a biblical teaching. It's a very unpopular teaching. The world sees that, and oftentimes they just sort of recoil with shock, like, who are you people? You know, what wagon train did you get off of? Those kinds of things. But the Bible does talk about that, and there's some purposes for it. It is generally redemptive. We think about Hebrews chapter 12, verses 5 through 11. The Bible teaches there that the Christian may be chastened, the Christian may be disciplined, because that, just like a child, is sometimes necessary in life. And when that happens, spiritual privileges may be forfeited. In this case, all, as you think about this fellow being cast out of the church and until the person decides to return back to God's fold, as we see from Luke chapter 15 and verse 7. You also see here, let's go back to 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 5, you see the redemptive nature of this punishment. Looking at the end of verse 5, he talks about the destruction of the flesh. Then he says that the flesh is destroyed, and that is not to be understood literally. At least that's the way I'm presenting this. It should go back into the world with this person, send them out of the church, that the spirit what? That the spirit may be saved. So Paul says, going to lose some connections with church folks. Ultimately, though, this is the reason for that. We want this person to be in a right relationship with God. So if we disconnect from them, that is a tough thing to do. You see sometimes people, especially very wealthy people, sometimes they have kids. And the kids, they go out and they get into legal trouble, they get into trouble with drugs, they get into trouble with gangs, And mom and dad with the big pockets do what? All right, you know, we'll get the best lawyers, and we'll get you the best rehab centers, and we'll do this and this and this. And oftentimes, mom and dad have been successful in life at doing that very kind of thing. But as you look at those kinds of things, you can see the connection here. If you sanction that behavior, and that's really what mom and dad would be doing in those kinds of cases, you know, we don't like your drug use, we don't like the people you're hanging around with, we don't like that you picked up another DWI, we don't like that stuff, but at the same time, if we spend the money, get the lawyers, and bail you out, in the end, what are we really doing?
Enabling.
Yeah, we're enabling. And do you help them?
No.
No. How do you help a child who does those kinds of things? Yeah, well, that's true. Let's be a little more specific. What's that mean?
Don't bail them out.
Yeah. I remember, mom can attest to this. She should remember this. Dad told me, if you get arrested, don't call me. Is that true or false? Okay, you don't have to answer. We'll just say that the silence is enough. I don't want to embarrass you. But anyway, yeah, I mean, that's what I heard. That's what I heard growing up. Just call me. Call mom. But that's what I was told. You know, if you go to jail, don't call. Now, again, you know, there could have been some special circumstance, but he meant by that, if you do something stupid and you go to jail, you know, your DWI or some other things that you shouldn't have been doing, you're going to spend the night in the jail. I am not, and I believe he would have done exactly what I heard.
John told our boys the same thing.
Yeah. Now, in today's world, you know, you would be the parent that would be up there in the billboard as far as the worst parent for 2023, those kinds of things. But you cannot tolerate some behavior. You simply can't excuse it. There are some things that do merit consequences or punishment. Anything that you want to add or ask? Okay. Let's pick up verse 6. He says, your glorying, your boasting is not good. Know ye not that a little leaven leaveneth the whole lump? So there was no excuse at all for the Corinthians to tolerate any kind of repeated sin, let alone this repeated sin. And as we said before, this is the sin of incest. I gave you some quotes as far as even the Gentiles didn't permit this kind of stuff. This would be like someone going to prison, and there's some things that you can do before prison that if they find out after you get to prison that you've done, your life is pretty much going to be beyond awful. All right, when you look at the Old Testament, we do have a number of laws as far as sexual activity. Exodus chapter 20 and verse 14, when you go through the Ten Commandments, for example, that prohibited adultery. When you think about people, if you have, over the years, you've known of people who were involved with some kind of sexual activity which was unauthorized, what have been some of the consequences from that that you've seen?
Yeah.
Well, yeah. You know, some guy, you know, starts running around with some guy's wife, and then all of a sudden, you know, he learns, and then, you know, she shot, and he shot, and, yeah, death has definitely been a consequence. What are some of the other consequences?
The effect on the family.
All right. You know, people sometimes talk about the black sheep in the family, or there is just sort of this permanent stain that is left, and there's just no way to really clean that up, at least 100%. So yes, there have been some lasting memories that have created some significant issues. What else?
Divorce.
All right. That's probably going to be, you know, right under the answer of death. A lot of people have said, you know, divorce, I just can't, you know, take that, can't stand that. I've got to go ahead and end the marriage. Anything else?
Venereal disease.
All right. There is somebody from a nursing background. So yes, you think about sexually transmitted diseases, all kinds of those in the world. I don't know how many there are. There are at least 100 plus, I would say. But anyway, you know, some may be easily treated, and I believe that we still have some which, if you get it, it sticks with you for life. So that's another one. Anything else as far as consequences that we've seen over the years?
Lose your job?
Well, there have been some people who have done that. We've seen that with politicians. So sometimes it's not someone who is, you know, just Joe Blow average, but there have been some high-profile people. And those accusations, I mean, there's some stuff floating around right now about Rudy Giuliani. I don't know if it's true or not, but that does seem to cling to a lot of people who have, we've seen presidents, multiple presidents on both sides of the aisle. Steve, there's still another answer here, I think, that we want to make sure that we bring out. What else?
What about, like, in medieval times, they would wear a scarlet letter,
yeah,
and now whatever the equivalent of that is today?
Yeah, we are probably not going to see much of that in America. But there are some cultures where people have actually been branded and some other things. So there are some cultures where that is an especially egregious. It's a very, very serious sin. So great point. Mom?
Children that are...
That's the one. we talk about, and I'm going to put this in air quotes, we talk about what kind of children. There are...
Disturbed.
No.
Illegitimate.
Well, there are those...
Unwanted
children. Well, I hate to call any child unwanted, because every person is made in the image of God. But there have been kids who have been brought into the world. Sometimes, you know, it's a teenage couple. You know, I grew up with people. Girl got pregnant. You know, hopefully that happens in a congregation. I will tell you this. I'm just going to pause here to tell you a little story. And this one, I'm sure, I've not told you before. We were in Montana, Air Force time, and there was a young couple, fine young couple. They were, he was, I don't know, probably 18, 19. He was Air Force. She was just a little younger, just barely of age as far as the state law. They got together. She got pregnant. The congregation came together and really supported that young couple. I mean, they didn't support what they did, but it was, all right, you know, here's the situation. You're in love. You want to get married. We're going to help you out. I still remember the mom in that situation. It was an Air Force family, so they had spent time in different parts of the U.S., maybe different parts of the world. And she said, had we been down south, had we been in a different location, my family would have been shunned. Now, I had not been a Christian for very long, less than a year. And I still remember those words. Now, maybe time has passed to the point where that would no longer be true. Maybe it would only be true in a few areas compared to back then. But I have thought about that many times over the years. That here were two kids who did something they should not have done, and yet somehow they were going to be stigmatized, maybe disfellowshipped, at least in their minds, and they probably were correct, had they been in another location. And I thought God would not have looked kindly on those people. Now, if the kids had been openly defiant, hey, you know, this is, you know, what we're going to do, and those kinds of things, that's a different story. But they were penitent. I think it probably did. I have no idea what happened to him, but I just know that that congregation, again, acted in an appropriate way, a biblical way, and I think you're exactly right. You know, that they were able to get through that. The congregation gave him as much grace and dignity as it could, and okay, you know, everybody sins. Yours is going to be a little more noticeable than some others and a little louder than some others, okay? But, you know, they got through it. So if you're ever in a congregation where you go through that kind of thing, bear that little story in mind. It might not be you. Maybe they're not good friends of yours, but the shoe could be on the other foot.
Several years ago, while we were still going to Garden City, there was in the news a woman who happened to be a member of the Church of Christ who was found guilty of adultery.
Yeah.
And she actually took the Church of Christ to court and tried to sue them because they had withdrawn fellowship from her. I don't know exactly how that came out, but I remember it was in the national news.
Collins Hill, Oklahoma, I believe is where that was.
Right.
Yeah. And again, I don't do much as far as following lawsuits, but I do believe that she eventually at some point prevailed to some degree financially. There was some discussion as far as how the elders handled that. And that, I guess let's just make a second little note here as well. If you ever have a congregation go through that, then bear in mind whoever is in the leadership role, they're having to make some of the most difficult decisions that they will ever make. And that begins with the process of saying we do need to disfellowship in this particular case. There are possible, especially in today's world, legal ramifications. You know, a congregation may be sued. And that can bring up a whole new list of problems. So this is not an easy area. And oftentimes when that type of thing does come up, there are, just like as we talked about on other occasions, there are things where, you know, you can see what's obvious, but you can't always see what's not obvious. And sometimes if you're not able to see what's not obvious, it's possible to come to some conclusions, maybe some strong beliefs or opinions. And, you know, you don't necessarily have all the details to support that. So this is really serious stuff. You see it from Paul's perspective, and this is not being addressed from any legal perspective. This is just simply from a biblical perspective, and it's serious enough that way. So hopefully in a local congregation, this kind of stuff never happens. But if you're a Christian long enough, you're probably going to be exposed to it at some level. And it's not easy. It's not fun. But, you know, people do sin. Some sin is very noticeable, some is not, and it's always bad, regardless. Ray, just a second. We'll take Gary's hand first. I saw him first.
A lot of the shock and awe of the public when they find out that a member's been disfellowshipped is because a lot of people just have a distaste for holding anyone accountable anymore, and not to get off on some soapbox, but, you know, just the enabling and the covering up things and, you know, just, oh, they're just coming from bad situations, so we're just going to ignore it. It really wasn't that bad. The rationalization has been a big problem. When we lived in Connecticut, our congregation was, I think, about 20 people, at the most 24, and we had to disfellowship a single man, and it wasn't for adultery or anything like that, but there was no eldership, so it was the men of the congregation, and it was incredibly difficult.
Yeah, and I'm not saying anything to diminish the congregation, but you're only dealing with 24 people. You multiply that times 4. You take 100 or even 50, and it gets exponentially more difficult. Or you look at a congregation, I mean, Harper's, you've been with a congregation of what, 300, 500?
Well, when we first started going to Woods and Chapel, it was a little over 600.
All right, so think about a congregation of 600 people. Chances are whoever is involved in something is connected to different people. And you're asking 600 people to get on board with a disfellowship. You have a rough road. And then, how many elders did you have there? Roughly, I'm not asking for an exact number.
I don't know, I'll say 10 or 12.
All right, so now you've got 10 or 12 elders. What happens if even just one of the elders has a different idea as far as how to proceed with a disfellowship? So now you not only have a congregational issue, now you have within the eldership an elder issue. So this stuff, hopefully people, you know, mind the P's and Q's and don't go down this road and you never have to deal with it. But in amendments, you've, like I say, you got some good seasoning there, some good training there, trial by fire, but it is incredibly difficult. I will just add, we're going to come back to Ray in just a second, but thank you. You know, here's another thing, just to let you know how complicated this is. What would be the case, let's use Gary's illustration, you've got 24 members, and this guy is the song leader. Only one song leader. This guy is the one who locks up the building and unlocks it. This guy is the biggest contributor. This guy is the Bible class teacher. This guy is the fill-in preacher, because the preacher you have is 92 and can't always be there. You know, we can grin and smirk about that, but folks, I'm telling you, that happens. And when that happens, people feel pressure. And what's the pressure in the scenario that I just described? We can't withdraw from him. Because if we do, what will we do? There's nobody to replace him. Well, that might be true as far as nobody to replace him. But you can end up like the Corinthians, and that's a bad place to be.
Basically, what I'm looking at here, in Corinth there, they didn't do anything about it. They maybe didn't talk about it, I don't know. But obviously they didn't do what was right. And it was a known thing that was going on. So, yeah. You see that here, we know what we need to do.
Yeah. And a lot of times that's, you know, all right, the problem is clear, the plan is clear. Is it easy? It's never easy. And might it seem like it's going to really damage us? Well, when people start, you know, it comes back to what we've talked about so many times. We walk by what versus what? We walk by faith versus sight. When somebody says, if we do this, it's going to cost us here and here and here and here and here. Where are you looking? Faith or sight? You're looking at sight, and you're looking at the wrong spot. Okay, switching gears a little bit. You would think, based on all the things that we just talked about, from a spiritual perspective and even in the world, when you see politicians lose their jobs and you see other people go through all the crises, you read about the divorces and you find about, you know, the kids, the lives are torn apart. I mean, it's just so sad. You would think that people would say, hey, this is not a good thing. But is that what we find in society? People say it is a good thing, right? What do we see? I mean, we see just about anything and everything. You know, I can go back about 15 years, and 15 years ago, I've got some notes that I took. There was a huge emphasis on same-sex rights, gay marriage, sexually deviant behavior, and, I mean, we've just seen that proliferate as the last, you know, 15 or so years have passed. So it's just like we talked about before. You create a little hole in the dam, and it's not going to be long before water just starts rushing through. And that's where we are as a society. At Corinth, it seems like the Christians went beyond toleration. They boasted, as you see here, they're proud of their stance. McKnight suggested they boasted in their false teacher as one who understood the gospel better than Paul and who perhaps had defended the incestuous marriage as a matter permitted by the gospel. Paul said that glorying is not good. Now, if you didn't catch that, I think he's exactly right. Remember we talked about from 1 Corinthians chapter 1, Paul said, there are some who say, I am of who? I am of Paul, I am of Apollos, I am of Cephas, I am of Christ. They've got all their little different parties. So if they've got all the little different parties, what are they teaching? Well, he doesn't give us necessarily a full list of everything they're doing. But I can see easily, because this is still sort of in that context of 1 Corinthians chapter 1, we're not that far removed, I can see him teaching, or reminding these Christians perhaps, that you are listening to people who are saying that this incestuous situation is wrong. Now here I am, I'm telling you it's wrong, but you've got teachers A, B, and C who says this is good. This shows Christian love. This shows Christian toleration. This is the correct way to go. Now, if that's indeed what's being described, you think Paul was pulling his hair out?
Yes.
Yeah. Saw some guy today, he said, I love your hair. I thought, well, if I was Paul, I wouldn't have any left probably. But, you know, he really had some difficulties dealing with some folks. Okay, a little bit more here. When you look at the word which is translated boasting, that seems to me to be based on more the object of the boasting. In other words, Paul is condemning the basis for the boasting. Here, they were so proud of what they were tolerating, it was actually the other way around. We've talked before about the Corinthians, that problem of wisdom that they had. They thought they were so smart. They thought that they were so wise. They thought that they were so well informed. If there is anybody that's in the know, it is us. We have it all figured out. But Paul's making the point, let me show you where your wisdom has taken you. It's taken you to the height. It's taken you to the great depths of foolishness. But they had the spiritual gifts and everything. And then as you look at what their thinking was, they said sin was a good thing. That's how open-minded they had become. And that was creating some huge issues. Anything you want to add or ask before we say some things about the leaven? Okay, let's talk about the leaven a little bit. He's continuing, just like Jesus sometimes continued to press the point forward a little bit more. You see that with the word leaven. Paul says, if you had just a little leaven, what does that quickly do? It
spreads.
All right, it spreads. It leavens the whole lump. And here I understand leaven. I'll give you the formal definition. The toleration of ethical misconduct. Have we not seen that as we look at the political realm? There is a little misconduct over here, and it doesn't get checked. It doesn't get stopped. What happens before too long? It just grows. It just goes like a weed. And before long, I mean, it seems like everybody and the brother is doing the stuff that is bad. So we know that in the physical realm, sometimes it only takes a slight illness to hurt or even kill the body. And that's also true. You may remember, I think it's Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 15, where the Hebrew writer talked about a root of bitterness. Anybody ever plant a root of something and you couldn't kill it off? I mean, we've had some plants like that. It's like, wow. What was that Japanese plant a few years ago got brought into the U.S.? Kudzu? Anybody remember that?
It's down in the south. Kudzu.
Yeah, okay. It didn't have the right pronunciation, but yeah. All right. But anyway, you know, hey, that's neat. Let's get some in. And all of a sudden, I mean, it's just like wildfire. You just can't get rid of it. And that's what Paul is saying when it comes to sin. It can easily damage. It can destroy an entire congregation. And, you know, I don't have a white shirt on tonight, but suppose I did. If I had just a small, just about that much of a blot right there, when you looked at me, what were you going to see? You're only going to see that. Isn't that interesting? Bob and I were talking about, you know, windshields not too long ago. You get a little nick in your windshield. I mean, you got this giant hunk of glass, and you take a little look at the windshield. What do you see? Where's the eye go? Zoom! Right there. You see that. So when you think about the Corinthians and that principle, what do you think they were thinking about? What do you think they were talking about? Huh? This guy. You know, well, you know, yeah, he's still doing that. We're good with that. No problem. Those kinds of things. So here you have the leaven standing for, it represents the man who is involved with this particular sin. So Christians should have been afflicted, they should have been affected, but that's simply not how it was. When you look at the first part of verse 6, you see that that is connected with the latter part of verse 6, the glorying, the boasting. Paul's talking about the little leaven and how that goes together. The toleration at first, and this is true so often in life. Somebody says, well, you know, yeah, maybe I can kind of see that, but let's just let it go. What happens when you tolerate a little that's wrong? Well, there's going to be a little bit more, and there's going to be a little bit more, and then there's going to be a little bit more. Our government has done that with money, hasn't it? We just need another 100 million. All right, then next year. Well, you know, we spent the 100 million last year. We just need how much this year?
2 million.
Let's just push it up to 500 million. So, and then it just goes up and up and up. There is no stopping. And that's just the way that people are. It just gets out of control at some point. So, you have, I think, Paul using this illustration. I'm not a baker, never been a baker. But if you put that yeast in the dough, initially, is there any reaction? Is it instant?
No.
All right, so you can put that in there, and you don't see anything for a little bit. But,
20 minutes.
Oh, yeah, I was thinking instantly. But, yes, you're right. But if it has a chance to sit there for a little bit, in this case, 20 minutes, then what happens? Then you begin to see some activity, and that's what happens as far as this as well. Okay, let's see. Let's get a couple more points in here, and then we'll shut it down and pick up verse 7 next week. Paul claimed that the action could affect the entire lump. What do you think the lump is? A little leaven. That's that little sin that we're talking about. Leaven's how much? The whole lump. There you go. It is the whole congregation. So sometimes people say, well, it's not hurting anybody. It's not going to affect anybody else. Guess what? It does. Now, there may be some cases where that is true, but when we're talking about this kind of stuff here, that's not how it works. When you look at the word leaveneth, it is a present tense verb, and again, I think Carol brought that out very well, that you put it in there, and you know the action kind of starts. It may take just a little bit for it to be seen, but it does take place. The Corinthians thought they were wise. We saw that back in chapters 3:18 and 4:10, but they did not understand. They did not apply the truth about leaven. So, in verse 7, Paul is going to give a command which might be summarized as, you're pure, so you start acting like it. Act like the people you're supposed to be.